You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the revered mother of all podcasts, The Brian Callen Hunter Motz Show. I have to say his name. I just have to. I mean, where would I be without Hunter Motz? I wouldn't have Wendy Chen, who is our esteemed guest. Wendy is a scientist, and she is, well, Hunter, give us her, you're good with big words.
Dr. Wendy Chen is a medical doctor and also has a master's of public health. She's an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School.
Never heard of it. Keep going.
Yeah, minor institution. She's also a medical oncologist at the Dana-Farber Institute and a cancer epidemiologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital.
Damn, Wendy! I'm just a stand-up comic and a really good boxer.
And her middle initial is Y.
And her middle initial is
correct.
Wendy, let's start. I had read an article that Wendy, and I think you co-authored with somebody about an aspirin, what aspirin does for cancer and something that people may not know and how it can, with certain cancers and with certain protocols, actually stop a recurrence of cancer and maybe even stop cancer altogether. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it was a very good article, and I said we got to get her on the podcast. But what I want to talk about before we do that is, you know, people always throw around the idea that, well, the scientists have found that such and such is the case. Or, people say, well, I drink a lot of green juice because it oxygenates my blood. Or I take these kinds of vitamins, or I take this, or I do yoga, whatever it is. And I think very few of us really understand, number one, how these kinds of things get into the mainstream, how these scientific quote-unquote truisms get into the mainstream. But most of us are scientific, at least like to think of ourselves as trusting science. And if science comes out and says, listen, leafy green vegetables will keep cancer at bay, we're going to start eating leafy green vegetables. But the question that I have, Wendy, we'll start with this, is how do you do your research? What does it mean to be published? And how do you arrive at these conclusions? Let's go through that, because you're obviously a credible, credited scientist who's been peer-reviewed over and over again. You've published many, many papers. And in the science world, that's legitimacy. That's what gives you your credo. So let's start with that.
I mean, there are a lot of questions that you asked, and I think they're all really important ones. So I think one of the first things to think about when you look at science and when you look at articles is how you decide, is this a reputable person or not? And that honestly can be something that's a little bit tricky sometimes, because sometimes people, unfortunately, will just put in Harvard Medical School when they may have gone there once a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And so it can be a little bit tricky when you're trying to understand these things from the internet. So part of it is choosing sources where you get your news that you feel that these are sources that carefully vet things and do a good job of looking at the background. But to really speak about, it seems to be pretty easy to figure out, does something help cancer or not? And it's actually a lot harder than you would think. If someone has active cancer, to figure out, does a particular drug or treatment help, that actually is fairly straightforward. So, for instance, you would have clinical trials in which there are groups of cancer patients that have active cancer, so cancer that you can measure, and you see, does their cancer get bigger or smaller with the treatment? What's of interest to a lot of people, and for instance, what our aspirin study was looking at, was can you prevent someone's cancer from coming back? And that's actually a much trickier thing to study, because you need really, really large groups of people. You need some people who got the treatment and then some people who didn't get the treatment as a comparison group, because what you're trying to see over time is, does the cancer come back over time or not? And it's not something that you can measure quickly or easily in just a few people. You need a really, really large study. And so when we look at, in medicine at least, at what we call the so-called gold standard of studies, is what's called a randomized trial. And that means they're randomly assigned to one of two treatments. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's a group of no treatment like placebo, because a lot of people are not always happy with that, but it means that there's a random assignment between two different treatments to see, is that treatment really better than just the standard treatment or no treatment at all. And these studies take a lot of time and a lot of money to do. And then the other thing is you want to make sure that you do it well. You want to make sure that the people who were supposed to get the treatment A, for instance, got treatment A, and people who were supposed to get treatment B actually took it and got it. You want to make sure that all of the people were appropriately found and followed, and that you didn't have a whole lot of people drop out. Because as you can imagine, if you have a whole lot of people drop out, then again, a study is difficult to interpret.
Or they skip 3 days, whatever it might be.
Right, exactly. And so that's why there's some studies. So even though, let's say, the study was randomized, if it turns out that, let's say, and this happens in some studies, that you were looking at a drug X, but this drug X caused so many side effects that more than half of the people never ended up completing a course of drug X, then it's hard to know how to interpret the results of that study. Let's say drug X didn't look like it was helpful. Well, was that because most of the people ended up not taking it? But it actually would have been helpful if people had stuck with it. I wish that there was an easy way that I could say, yes, just look at this checklist of things and this will tell you, is it definitely a good study or not? But I would definitely say that one thing is to look at is randomized studies in general are definitely considered better quality studies. Mm. The bigger the study is in general, it's going to be a better quality study. Because if you're only looking at something in like 10 or 20 people, you have to worry that is there something different or special about those 10 or 20 people? Could those things happen by chance? But if you're looking at a study in which there's thousands of people who are enrolled, those kinds of studies are most likely going to have more believable and accurate results. And then also, and this is the part where it's tricky for someone who's not in the field, is there's certain journals and there's certain forums that are that has a much more careful vetting process. And I guess in the journalism world, it would sort of be like if you find that something's in the New York Times, you've hoped that all their fact checkers and everyone else and their editors and everyone had looked at it carefully before they put it in the New York Times, so you feel comfortable with it.
Sure.
Versus reading something in like Star Magazine or something like that, which yeah. you don't know how well it's been vetted, and they've been sued for putting things there incorrectly.
Yeah, exactly.
And so in the medical world, there's a similar hierarchy. With journals like the New England Journal of Medicine, JAMA, which is the Journal of American Medical Association, sort of considered some of the top-tier journals.
How about The Lancet?
The Lancet also is considered a top-tier journal as well.
Just to clear up for the listeners, that's basically the British Medical Association's journal.
Right.
Right.
And I'm sorry to interrupt, but when you publish a study, you have to have it. What is peer reviewed? Does that mean three people in your field, independent people, have to look at the data and then give it their stamp of approval?
Yeah. So usually there's a peer review is actually a much more difficult and burdensome process than it would sound. So the first thing that happens is, especially if you go to one of these big journals, they have an editorial staff. So the editorial staff is the first one. And for the top journals, less than 5% of articles will get accepted that are sent in.
Wow.
So the first step is that the editorial staff will look through, I think similar to, some Hollywood company in which they get a whole bunch of scripts sent in. There's someone who does some culling and says, look, I don't think this is going to work or this is potentially going to work. So there's an editorial staff that does sort of that first sort through.
Are they all doctors and scientists themselves?
No, not necessarily. Because for some of the, there's some things that are just obviously are not going to be good enough quality, either because they're too small, they're not done properly. So in someone who has who has been trained to do this, they can actually do the initial culling. And you don't have to worry that, oh, gee, maybe they accidentally threw something out by accident. Okay. So they really do sort of the first very kind of rough cut. And then after that, then it's generally sent out to three different physicians. And they do have to be careful. You don't want to send it to their friends because obviously they're going to give it a good review. And you don't want to also send it out to someone who are their known enemies either because, again, then they're going to get a negative review.
But
then it's hopefully sent to three different people who hopefully would be able to provide independent, unbiased reviews. And the other thing that's generally done, although not all journals do it, most journals do it, is they keep the reviews confidential. that is the identity of the reviewer. Because as you can imagine, if I put my name on something and I know that this other person's going to read it, I may not feel as comfortable about speaking freely and openly.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But
right.
if I know that I'm going to be anonymous, then I would feel more comfortable writing critically about something.
So the physician is allowed to stay anonymous.
Right, right.
Okay.
There are a few journals that don't allow that. They actually want both the reviewers and the authors to know each other's identities, but that's actually the exception. Most of the top journals, the reviewers are allowed to stay anonymous to the author, and what happens is, you know, an independent person collates the comments together and sends them to the author. And then, so those three people will then give their recommendations of yes or no, should this be accepted? And then there actually is an editorial staff that is either doctors or PhDs. And then they would then also read the articles themselves critically. Mm. And then the decision then would either to be reject, or else it may be that, oh, you need to make these changes, or else they may say, oh, maybe you should try submitting to this other journal that we think it would be a better focus for. And this whole process can sometimes take, 6 months to a year.
Well, actually, we had Spiros Michalakis, who's a quantum physicist at Caltech, on, and I had mm-hmm. lunch with him afterwards, and he was saying that he had a paper that was accepted after 4 years.
For me, the record was 2.
Yeah.
After 4 years.
Because there's a process of finding the right journal. There's a process of, you know, you
right.
often get notes and you have to rewrite the article. Like, it's really an elaborate process.
How often are these journals printed? Like, let's say JAM or New England Journal of Medicine or The Lancet. How often do they come out with a new journal?
Weekly.
Weekly?
Weekly, yeah.
And how large are they typically?
Most of them would have anywhere between 5 to 10 research articles per issue.
And so everybody, I'm sure, in the medical field, or most people, will read this. I mean, this is where most doctors change their mind or get their information from.
Yeah. So most doctors, what they do is, you're right, regardless of specialty, most people like to know what's in the JAMA and New England Journal. Those are the ones, when you look at articles that are picked up, for instance, by the New York Times, Washington Post, by sort of the large newspapers, it's generally going to be, it's often going to be articles from JAMA New England Journal, though not exclusively. So most physicians do try to keep on top of JAMA New England Journal. And then after that, it depends on your particular specialty. So people who are interested in cancer research, there's a group of journals that I would then also follow up. But for instance, if you're a cardiologist, a heart doctor, there may be a different set of journals that you'll look at it as well that would also be considered prestigious. And sometimes an article goes into those journals, even though it's really good, but it just has a very narrow focus. So if article only has a very, very narrow scientific or medical focus, it may not be picked up by JAMA New England Journal, not because it's not a good article, but because they're trying to pick articles that have more appeal to physicians overall.
Right.
Right. And just as an exercise in contrast, so we've seen mm-hmm. all the checks and balances that go into a peer-reviewed article in one of the major, most reputable journals. Let's mm-hmm. talk about the sort of studies that you see floating around on the internet, which are mm-hmm. very often like, oh, I did this experiment on myself, and I found that in myself, I subjectively had this experience of feeling like I had more energy, or, you know, it's about, you know, something that you did with your 12 friends, you
right,
know, the,
right.
and it's not being peer-reviewed, and there aren't controls. Why? Let's even talk about that. Why are controls so important?
Yeah, so to controls, just to explain what that is that you generally have to have a group that has no treatment or else has some kind of placebo or a dummy pill, because sometimes when people are interested and invested in something, it can make them feel better. So what's interesting, for instance, is one area that they look a lot about controls is pain. So almost any study that's done looking at pain has to have some type of control or placebo or no treatment group, because a lot of people, if they're sort of invested in something and thinking that, oh, my pain's going to get better, their pain actually will get better. Because even though, yes, pain is a physical thing, you can actually control a little bit how you experience that pain. Does that make sense?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are examples over and over again of how powerful the placebo effect is.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so another area of research that I do is hot flashes that women experience when they go through menopause. And again, that's a known biological phenomenon. No one thinks that hot flashes are in a woman's mind. It's a biological phenomenon with menopause. But if you look in the studies in which they have a placebo group, usually about 25% of the placebo group gets better taking a placebo.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Right. And I mean,
the power of the mind.
Yeah. And a lot of this is even just how well people report. I mean, it may not even be
exactly.
that their pain is less. It's just that if I say to you, what's your pain on a scale of 1
yeah.
to 10,
yeah.
you're like, oh, it's only a 3. Like,
yeah.
I'm feeling
exactly.
great.
They'll
yeah.
say, you know, I started taking this pill, and you know what? I think I do feel a little bit better now.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's just, it's not that the pain wasn't real. The pain is real. But how you experience it and how you grade it may differ between what your perspective is on it.
So let's, go on. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, just getting back to, because I think that's another important point that you made about, you know, when you see these things on the internet, how do you understand what to do with it? I think one important thing, and this sounds sort of silly, is when someone says they're a doctor, to find out what kind of doctor they are.
Mm.
You'd be surprised at the number of people on the internet who are doctors, but they're actually not medical doctors.
Well, you can also get your PhD from certain.
Exactly.
You can do ridiculous research. There's a famous health food, health, you know, alternative health guru in England. I can't remember her name. And they took a look at where she got her PhD, and it is ridiculous.
Exactly.
It's just, you know, you can publish something on, you know, how my blueberries grew in my window.
Yeah.
You know, literally,
and how
you can pay. Yeah, there are you can pay certain companies to give you, you know, a PhD from their quote unquote online
exactly.
college.
So. Right. And if you have a PhD, you are allowed to call yourself a doctor. And this came up was there was this cancer treatment called 714X that was this complementary treatment that was very popular for a while, and it was promoted by this doctor so-and-so, and it turned out he had a PhD in microbiology from, you know, a long, long time ago. And obviously someone who has a PhD in microbiology is not going to be well-trained in how to treat cancer.
Really? Why is that? That's interesting.
Well, microbiology, I think first to clear up what microbiology
oh,
is
yeah,
really dealing
you.
With. Is really
yeah.
dealing with like bacteria and viruses
exactly.
and all that sort of stuff, as opposed
exactly.
to irregular cell growth, which is cancer. Like they're two totally
exactly.
different domains.
Wow.
Right.
They may both be in science, but it's kind of like. If
so
you
he
had
should have his degree in oncology.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Wendy?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And their work should really be sort of. It doesn't have to be specifically in their degree doesn't have to be in cancer because it may be called something slightly different, but it needs to be an area of expertise that is related to the study of cancer if the person is looking at cancer treatment. So that actually is one very quick thing that I always tell people is that when they see something on the internet and the person says they're a doctor, find out what they're a doctor in and then where did they get the doctorate from. And that information should be easily available.
Yeah, that's
on that person.
Really important. I've read some books on this. Michael Spector wrote a book called Denialism. I read a book by Dr. Ben Goldacre, called Bad Science about this. I mean, there's been a lot of books written about this.
Yeah, and I would also, I mean, in terms of study design, the best book I've ever read on that is Siddhartha Mukherjee's The Emperor of All Maladies.
Yes, that's
yeah.
a great book. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and The Emperor of All Maladies is a history of cancer, but one of the things that he does so well is he goes through study by study by study how they figured these things out, and then a lot of times what you'll find out is they had this study, it was brilliant, and then they realized that there's some flaw in the way that the study was designed and that actually the results are meaningless, and then they overturn all of
Jeez.
Those findings.
Mm-hmm. So, Wendy, what do you know about cancer? What do you know about, should we all be taking aspirin? What's the best way to prevent this disease you've been studying for a long time? And what's the best way to, you know?
What I've spent a lot of my time doing is looking specifically at breast cancer. And right now, the way that I would say that the data on aspirin and breast cancer is it's definitely very promising. But the main reason we haven't told everyone to take aspirin yet is because there are actually bleeding risks associated with aspirin when you take it every day for a long period of time.
Mm.
So you really want to make sure that the amount of benefit that you're getting from aspirin is greater than any of the risks that you have from aspirin. And that's why for something like this, you would really need to do a randomized trial to answer that question.
But you guys have done that, haven't you?
No, that's what we're trying to get funding for. And that really was part of the reason why we wrote the piece. It wasn't so much to get funding directly for ourselves, but to really have people recognize that with the cuts in government funding to cancer research and to research, we're increasingly dependent on the pharmaceutical companies to fund things.
Oh boy.
And the pharmaceutical companies want to fund things that they're going to be able to make money off of.
Mm.
And the pharmaceutical companies do not make a lot of money off of generic drugs.
Oh boy.
And the other thing that I would also note in terms of how you, you know, tell, excuse my French, shit from Shinola is, you know, I mean, if you listen to the way that Dr. Chen is talking, she's being very clear. We know this. We don't know this yet. This is what we have to figure out. We have to do this study, like, and all of that sort of stuff. And there's a very, very clear, like, when you talk to people who are reputable scientists, they're very, very clear about which questions they can answer with what degree of certainty, what are the problems, what are the things that are unknown. They generally don't make these big sweeping claims or big generalizations.
Right, because they're scientists.
Yeah.
And they start with doubt and having to prove things.
That's right.
Thank God.
And even once they have, in inverted commas, proved something, always second guessing those conclusions.
Right.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely true.
So talk to us though. There is, it seems, based on preliminary studies, that an aspirin regimen, or at least aspirin itself in preventing cancer from recurring, has some promise, and it could in the future, depending on how your study goes, be something that doctors prescribe to people under certain instances. By the way, there are different kinds of cancers, aren't there? I mean, when you talk about breast cancer,
oh, absolutely.
You know, that's not the same as pancreatic cancer. It's not the same as colon cancer. It's not the same as
And not only that, I mean, even within pancreatic cancers, there are many different kinds. You know, within and we think, obviously, as lay people, we tend to think in terms of organs. But there are so many different things that are going on a cellular level in terms of what mutations are driving that cancer.
Exactly. No, that's definitely true. And I think that's a good point, that things that help prevent or treat one cancer may not necessarily help or prevent or treat another cancer. For instance, smoking, as you know, definitely increases the risk of lung cancer, but it doesn't increase risks of all cancers. Smoking probably has a modest effect on breast cancer. It does have a small increased risk, but not as big a risk as it does for lung cancer. And so it definitely is true that when we look at both treatments and also risk factors, we really have to look at a cancer-specific way.
Why do you think cancer rates are so low in many indigenous populations? For example, and not even indigenous, my God, I mean, if you look at Japanese women, there was that study, until sort of the Western diet came along, they really did have a very low incidence of breast cancer. Why is that? Is that, it sounds to me, or it feels like diet certainly plays a large factor in
I think that's a fascinating question. Is, you know, when you look, for instance, like you said, at the U.S. and you look at Africa and you look at China and Japan, the types of cancers that they develop is very different in the different areas. And as you were also saying, it's really fascinating to see the changes that have occurred specifically in China, because it has industrialized so rapidly. And the cancers that are mainly increasing in China, lung cancer is a huge problem in China. That's actually mainly among men. The rates of smoking among men in China are extraordinarily high right now. And part of it is that the Chinese government makes money off of cigarettes.
Wow.
It's all nationally owned.
Centralized planning. Yes,
exactly.
Yes.
They have no incentive to decrease smoking.
You mean the Chinese Politburo doesn't care about the average man on the street? I've never heard of that in history.
Right.
Notice
how Dr. Chen laughs, but does not comment. Because she would at some point like to return to China, maybe do some research there.
Are you a Chinese national?
I was born in the U.S., but my family's actually from Taiwan.
Oh, from Taiwan.
Oh, good. There you go.
There you go. She's a Chiang Kai-shek supporter.
Yes, that's right.
Let's talk about sort of, you've done a lot of research, and let me just tell you what I do. Not that I matter, but from what I have read as somebody who's into health and tries to stay in shape and keeps trying to keep the clock at bay. I stay away from sugar. I try to not eat sugar because I've read a lot of, you know, I don't know how scientifically credible, but I also know from athletes and from people that sugar, corn syrup, and simple carbohydrates, muffins and cereals and things, create an insulin response in your body, and that when your pancreas creates too much insulin over a long period of time, that's not so good for your health. It can lead to all kinds of things like quote-unquote inflammation. Have no idea what that really means. Energy swings and all that stuff. So I stay away from that. I try to get my carbohydrates from tubers, potatoes, more complex things, vegetables, and
that's great.
Yeah, and I eat meat because I like it, and I think it's good for you, and I don't care what anybody says.
And that's okay. I'm okay with that.
Yeah. And then I try to keep my alcohol consumption somewhat moderate. I do a lot of blow, a lot of cocaine, only when I'm on the road. No,
but that's for his art. That's for his art.
Right.
It's really not.
That's right. Yeah. I'm married with two kids, so sex is, it's not like my household is a porn set. But listen, we do our best. But anyway, so every time I talk to somebody, it always feels as though if you want to be as healthy as you can, just, it's called moderation. Eat whole, nutritious foods, get lots of sleep, drink water, and try to stay away from sugar and processed carbs.
And certainly tobacco
and cigarettes.
Alcohol.
So tobacco's huge.
Yeah,
it really is.
I don't smoke. So what do you think? Yeah. How am I doing so far?
No, I think if you sort of look at the list of what is the best thing to have longevity. So really, all the studies really agree on what diets are sort of associated with the longest life. Where the studies haven't entirely disagreed is there a diet specifically that's going to prevent someone from getting cancer? And that's the part that we really don't have a great answer for. But we know in terms of the longest life, sort of the healthiest lifestyle, is definitely, we call it a Mediterranean diet. But it doesn't have to be sort of, you know, Italian Mediterranean food, because it can be an Asian diet. But it really is something very like what you described, something that's low in saturated fat, is very high in whole grains, high in fruits and vegetables, high in lean proteins, low-fat dairy is fine, but not high-fat dairy.
You see, that actually there are a lot of people that would disagree with the high-fat thing, because a lot of people who do primary research on this, from what I understand, and certainly athletes, they believe in taking in a lot of fat, avocados, raw nuts, even
well,
butter.
Well, no, when I say high fat, I should have been clearer, high saturated fat.
Well, but you've been talking about butter and
exactly.
Fat.
So things, right, so things like avocados, or olive oil, all those things, those are very high in sort of monounsaturated fats, but not high in the saturated fat. So when I say high fat, I should have been clearer, we want to decrease, keep the saturated fat low.
Even saturated fat, I've heard from people who, you know, it increases your testosterone, and it's a lot of people encourage saturated fats. So that's it. But then again, this is where
we get
all over the place, right? People are, I know athletes though, I know a lot of athletes and their coaches and the people that work with athletes, like Barry Spears, who wrote the Zone Diet and stuff.
Yeah, but that's the point. These are not coming from peer-reviewed journals. These are like, I'm Barry Jones. I'm a coach. This is what I feel. Or, you know, I mean, a lot of these people. So, I mean, that's the question, Dr. Chen. What does the literature say about saturated fat? I know that you've done research, for example, on the effect of red meat on cancer.
Right. So, I mean, I think what's important to remember is what is the goal? What is the goal of your particular diet? And I think there definitely is a diet that if someone's an athlete, they're trying to maximize athletic performance, there's a certain diet you would choose versus someone whose main goal is, I want to decrease my risk of heart disease, decrease my risk of cancer, and live as long as possible.
Those are
two different things.
That is
so, for
true.
Instance, someone who is an athlete, they actually tend to overconsume calories. I mean, I'm sure you've seen what Michael Phelps eats when he trains.
Yeah.
And no one's going to recommend that everyone eat like Michael Phelps. That's because when you're training, you have to eat those excess calories. So the kinds of diets that trainers will develop to maximize performance are not necessarily going to be the diets that we would recommend to everyone else for a long life and to decrease cancer.
Because most of us are not training like Olympic athletes. We're walking around and living our lives.
That exactly. So most of us can't eat 10,000 calories a day and not have to worry about gaining weight.
Yeah.
You know?
And what we eat is probably should be different as well, because the fact is that if you're Michael Phelps, you need just as much energy as you can get. And so whatever those energy sources are. But if you're, you know, I mean, I'm sure simple carbs are probably a bigger part of his diet than they would be.
Exactly. They actually do. And you know that before they race, before usually a day or two, they actually all carbo load.
They need the glycogen and all that
That's right.
Exactly. But we're not going to recommend someone who's not racing to carbo load.
Sure. Now, what did your research on red meat and cancer?
There happens some studies. And so we really, I personally eat red meat myself. I'm not a vegetarian, and so I agree that things in moderation. So what I tell my own patients is to not eat it on a daily basis. So if they're going to have red meat, it's okay, and to just try to keep it to a few servings per week.
Because
the increased risk of cancer really does appear to be mainly people who are eating red meat on a daily basis, and the type of red meat that seems to increase cancer risk more would be processed meats. So things like sausages, hot dogs, bacon, ham, those sorts of.
So not venison that you shot yourself in Montana.
Right. But and also the important thing to remember, and especially this is true in Asian cultures, is you don't necessarily need to eat a huge piece of meat.
Right.
You know, you can have some meat in the dish and still, you know, get the enjoyment and get the flavor without having a huge piece.
Without having a 32-ounce steak.
We have fairly large control groups for this. I mean, Argentina, I think, eats a lot of beef, don't they? Do we see an increase in cancer in Argentina and places like that? Or am I wrong about them eating a lot of red meat?
I actually don't know in Argentina. So the way that we've done our studies, because it does get a little bit tricky when you try to compare different countries, because when you look at different countries, there's so many things that are different.
Yeah.
So if you look at an Argentinian's diet compared to the U.S., it's not just that they eat more red meat. There's so many things that they eat that are different. And so that's why when we tend to look at nutrition factors, we tend to like to look within one particular country and then look at different groups of people, some who eat less red meat and some who eat more. So that's how the study is being done, because then the main thing that's changing is the meat, versus if, you know, 10 different things are different, then it's hard to know, was it the meat or was it something else?
Right.
The other question that I had as well is, and actually our engineer, Reen Marie, has a question for you in a second, but the first thing that I wanted to ask is, there's a very interesting phenomenon, I think, that's going on in sort of the public's understanding of health, which is the difference between eating whole foods and eating their components. So, for example, you know, I think the literature would generally support the idea that you need to eat vegetables, but I come from a biochemistry background, and so to some extent it seems like, well, vegetables, just, you know, a mix of chemical compounds, why should it be any different eating them in the form of a vegetable versus eating them in the form of, you know, individual extracts or supplements? Like, if there are certain beneficial compounds in, you know, vegetables like chlorophyll or whatever it may be, why not just take supplements of those things?
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting question. And the pendulum's really has swung a lot on that. And it used to be that everyone was told, oh, you should take a vitamin because that's going to help make you healthy. But then as it turns out, there were quite a few randomized studies in which people took vitamins. And in someone who's already eating a reasonable diet, just taking a regular vitamin probably doesn't help. Just a regular multivitamin probably doesn't help protect against disease all that much. And it does seem that when you take something as a food-based source rather than as a supplement, that the body may absorb things differently. And then the other thing is, when you take something as a food-based source, so for instance, if you eat an apple, you're not just getting all the chemical nutrients, or not the chemical, all the sort of the natural ingredients in that apple. You're also getting the fiber from the skin. You're getting the fiber from the pulp. You're getting all these other extra things versus if someone just handed you apple juice. I mean, that's why we usually tell people to eat an apple rather than just drink even natural apple juice, is that you're still getting more benefits from eating the whole fruit than the individual components of it, because there may be a benefit to that whole combination of components, but then also, like I said, the fiber and other things that you can get in the whole fruit.
And because the other thing is that when you drink apple juice, it tastes much sweeter than when you eat an apple. So it seems like probably the process of juicing also frees up a lot more of that sugar. And so it moves mm-hmm. from being a more slow release of sugar into your body to a sudden spike.
Right. And then the other thing is that, as you can imagine, you can drink a lot of apple juice and not feel that full. There are only so many apples you can eat before you start feeling full.
So you stick to mostly whole nutritious foods, vegetables, some lean meats, and some non-saturated fats, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you say whole foods, I do think, and I understand it can be hard for people, it does help to cook yourself and mm-hmm. make the meals yourself. Because when someone else does the cooking, you know, whole foods or someone else like that for you, you don't have as much control over what's going in there.
I've heard that certain fats like rapeseed oil and those kinds of things, canola oil, are not good for you.
It depends. I mean, there's some kinds of oil. So even though coconut water is very trendy right now, coconut oil is actually quite high in saturated fat. Palm oil is very, very high in saturated fat.
Everybody's everybody's cooking in Hollywood with coconut oil. And
I know.
They say it's good for you.
I think that right now that is the whole coconut fad right now, but my guess is that's going to blow over
really?
In another.
Here's a question that I really want to ask you as well. So have you heard of butter coffee?
Yes,
yeah.
I did hear about that.
Right. So what do you think about the idea of every morning in your cup of coffee having a half stick of butter? Do you think
delicious.
That's good for you?
It's delicious.
Yeah. I didn't realize it was a half stick of butter. I thought it was much less.
Oh, it's pretty aggressive.
Wendy, whatever you say, I'm eating butter. I don't care what you say.
No, but I mean.
I love butter.
They do that for energy, right? But the question is, what is consuming that much butter every day for you?
Let me defend that comes from Dave Asprey. Dave Asprey, who went to Tibet and noticed that a lot of the Sherpas.
Right. They drink yak butter tea. Tibet. Yeah.
Right. They put it in there. It's like a porridge. They make it a tea. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, they seem to be living pretty healthy and long lives. So I think that's where Dave was like, look, let's get some grass-fed butter. It is delicious.
It is delicious. There's no doubt about that. But so is a cupcake.
Sure.
I mean, you know, I think that's the question is, has anything been done on that in general? You know, I mean, does saturated fat, I mean, seems to be bad for your risk of cancer. It seems to be bad for
I mean, it really is everything done in moderation. I personally use butter when I cook. I use heavy cream when I cook. And again, if you look at
that's what the French do.
In European cultures, exactly. I was going to say, they're the prime example. They use a ton of heavy cream or butter. But I think what's important to remember is that it's the quantities. If you go to France, the amount of food that they put on your plate is not the same as in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It's much smaller. And then the other thing is that you take much more time to eat the meal, which ends up eating smaller quantities. In the U.S., where people tend to like run in 5 minutes and try to eat as quickly as they can, then that's when you end up sometimes consuming more calories than you realize.
Do you anything else besides eat good food? Do you take any supplements? What do you do?
I personally don't. I actually used to take a vitamin a day, but all the research really has shown that if someone is eating a reasonably well-balanced diet, a vitamin a day really doesn't help. So I personally don't do that.
Do you think that it may do any harm?
And I actually don't recommend to my patients. If my patients ask me, do you think I should? I say that if you're eating a well-balanced diet, it probably doesn't add anything. I don't think it's harmful. Mm-hmm. So if they want to continue it, I allow them to. Mm-hmm. But I don't recommend that they should. And this is different. I used to, but I don't anymore.
You're not working. And again, athletes might be a very different situation when you push your body.
Oh, yes, that's very different.
Yeah.
And the other thing that's important is obviously if someone is pregnant or contemplating pregnancy, then they have to take vitamins for that.
Folic acid and things like that.
Exactly. And then the other group that sometimes is different is elderly people, if maybe their nutrition and their diet isn't as sort of well-balanced as it should be, then someone like that I might recommend.
So like my grandfather who lives on a diet of white bread and lunch meat probably should take.
Right, exactly. Someone like that, right.
You know, it's amazing. I got a lot of flack. I had Dr. Paul Offit on the podcast, and I'd read a number of books on sort of whether or not vitamins in large doses or whatever antioxidants were good or bad for you. And man, did I get, I got some flack from people who, you know, really believe in that protocol. And,
oh,
you know,
absolutely.
And some of them
there
are athletes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing how volatile the subject became, because people have their orthodoxies and people have their own research and things like that. And what struck me was that, you know, there's a lot of, I don't know, you research cancer, you work with cancer. Do you guys, is there any evidence from your research?
Mm-hmm.
And I know you're mostly a breast cancer specialist, but
yes,
from also your colleagues, are they working to, has there been any evidence that, say, vitamin C, vitamin protocol in whatever dose, or any of these, vitamin D, any of these things, are these things good for helping prevent or prevent the recurrence of or prevent cancer in general? Do we see any evidence of that?
Yeah, I would say the area that's the most interest for cancer would be vitamin D.
Right.
So there have been several studies that have shown that people with lower vitamin D may have a higher risk of developing cancer or a higher risk of cancer recurrence, the cancer coming back. The reason why those studies have been tricky to interpret and why we still are trying to do randomized trials in that area is that people who have low vitamin D also tend to be people who are less physically active, because if your vitamin D is low, it may mean you're spending a lot of time indoors.
Mm.
So it may be that you're less physically active. Overweight people also tend to have a lower vitamin D. And physical activity and weight are both things associated with developing cancer and cancer coming back. And so that's the part that we have to find out, is it really the vitamin D that's the issue, or is it things that are causing the vitamin D to be low that are the issue?
I heard that athletes have a lower incidence of cancer than the average person. Is that true?
It depends upon what types of cancers. Mm. You know, in general, athletes are not smokers.
Okay.
So the risk of lung cancer is generally going to be lower.
Okay.
We do know that specifically for breast cancer, people who are more physically active do have a lower risk of breast cancer. So I do recommend to my patients to try to be physically active. And that's usually defined as 30 minutes of brisk walking at least 3 times a week.
That's not much exercise. That's
right. I'm not asking people to run a marathon.
Right.
I'm not asking people that they have to, you know, do CrossFit or anything like that. I think that's very doable, but you'd be really surprised in the U.S. how few people even reach that level.
I know. Well, they're not as vain as I am. So. I push myself. Yeah.
And also, it's not just people in California, in Hollywood.
Yeah, exactly.
You get a rather skewed idea of physical activity there.
I was in New York with a bunch of friends. I go, I got to wake up early. I got to work out. They all started laughing because they thought I was joking, and
right,
I wasn't.
Exactly.
I was like, haha, I'm joking. I'll stay out. No, I'm just kidding. I'm not into this.
I think that, by the way, what you were just talking about is a really good example of the sort of flaws that can creep into study design in terms of, yes, athletes are people who tend to smoke less. And so, you know, the decreased risk of cancer among them may have nothing to do with the fact that they're exercising, but because the identity they have, the group they have, the
exactly.
priorities that they have mean that they don't do certain behaviors. I remember as well, I think this was in Siddhartha Mukherjee's book, again, The Emperor of All Maladies. He was talking about that the early studies that showed that coffee caused cancer had not controlled for the fact that coffee drinkers were also more likely to be smokers.
Exactly.
And that the smoking was actually what was causing the cancer.
Right, exactly. Coffee really has not been good, you know, for all, and I'm a coffee drinker, coffee has not been associated with any increased risk of cancer of any type.
Booyah.
That's awesome. You know, it is amazing. You know, I always wonder if we'll ever reach any definitive conclusions, and we do reach them, but the body and our behavior and our environment are just, they're ever moving, ever changing. I mean, it's so complex. And then you add to the fact that everybody's body is different and everybody's
right.
genetics
mm-hmm.
are different and everybody mm-hmm. has a different, you know. So what may affect some people develop lung cancer from smoking, and some people actually don't. Some
exactly.
people don't get cancer from smoking. So
that's exactly right.
It's a really hard thing to draw any of these. We
but
live in a world that wants to draw conclusions and very strong ones, and it's hard to do that.
But it's a question. I mean, I think that's the important thing to realize. This is all a question of probabilities, right?
Mm-hmm.
The fact is
mm-hmm.
you can't say if you smoke, you'll get lung cancer.
Mm-hmm.
But you can say, listen, you're rolling the dice if you smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a good chance that it's going to come up not in your favor. So what's the smartest bet to make? And I think also to realize, I think what Dr. Chen has done really, really well is to emphasize this is all trade-offs. It's not a question of, you know, you must do this or you mustn't do this. You can eat red meat if you want. Just know that if you're going above a certain level a week, you're increasing your risk.
Especially if it's processed red meat.
That's right.
Right, exactly.
Also, Rena Marie had a question. Did you want to ask it or do you want me to ask it? I'll ask it. So one of the things that you hear a lot in LA in terms of cancer is about high alkalinity, that essentially the pH balance in your body, if the pH balance in your body gets off, that makes cancer, it makes cells more likely to turn cancerous.
That's very sort of trendy right now, not just in LA, but there's a lot of books out there looking at sort of acid versus alkaline diet. What people don't realize is that even though it is true that you can choose foods that are more acidic or more alkaline, that's actually very easy to do. What's much harder to do is actually change your body's pH. Your body's pH is extremely tightly regulated by the kidneys, and it's only allowed to vary by very few points. If it's too high or too low, the body basically shuts down. So even if you, for instance, ate a very, very high acid diet, it would be virtually impossible to change your body's pH that way, because the kidneys actually would just compensate and get rid of that extra acid in someone whose kidneys are working.
I love scientists. You know, I love it.
Yeah.
Right. So yes, it is true that you can assemble diets that are very acid and very alkaline, but what's not true is you really cannot change your body's pH just with diet alone.
And I think a really good way for people to understand that is what you're talking about is homeostasis, which is that the body maintains a constant internal environment. And the way in which we all appreciate that is temperature, right? You can go outside and it can be hot. And, you know, your body makes sure that although, you know, your skin may be hot, the internal temperature is basically the same.
Exactly. You could drink as much ice water as you want. You could, you know, drink all the ice water in the world, and you're not really going to change your internal temperature. You could drink all the hot beverages that you want, and you're not going to change your body's internal temperature because it's going to regulate. The only exception would obviously be if you're in some kind of extreme circumstance, if you're in the desert and you have no access to water.
Right.
So same thing. You could change your acid or your alkali of your body if you were in some kind of extreme circumstance in which you had, for instance, intravenous infusion or something like that. But in a regular everyday circumstance, it really would not be possible to do that.
Because you're not a lizard.
I think a lot of where a lot of this stuff comes from for people, and I'm going to use the word alternative medicine, is that there are still things that medical science can't explain in our bodies. I mean,
and can't fix.
Pains in our backs, pain that we have, fatigue, and they can't figure out where it's coming from and all those things. And so people go, I need help here. And they'll go somewhere and look for it, whether it's green juice every day or whatever. And like you said, if you think it's going to make you feel better, then it probably is.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's probably where a lot of that comes from as well.
Ask her about her thoughts on alternative medicine.
Alternative medicine, I don't want to get into alternative medicine so much because I think the way Paul Offit said is that the term alternative medicine, we should just say there's medicine that works, medicine that doesn't. It should be very objective. Let's look at the actual data. Just look at the data and let's draw conclusions from that. That's really the way to do it.
I think the important point to realize is, I mean, you know, and I hate to reference Donald Rumsfeld here, but, you know, there are known knowns, there are known unknowns, there are unknown unknowns, and there are unknown knowns. Like, there are things that science knows for sure, and that we know that we know, and there are some things that may one day turn out to be true, but we just don't have the data to be able to say them definitively. And for example, with your aspirin thing, right? We don't yet know whether everybody should be taking aspirin to prevent the incidence of breast cancer. We may know that in a year or two after you've done the study.
It'll take 5 years.
5 years, yeah, or 5 years.
But I know that they did years of study actually on echinacea and how it affects the common cold, and they found that it doesn't. I mean, if you look at all the literature, they did real studies on it. Guess what? It doesn't. And I took it for years. In fact, from what I understand, even vitamin C doesn't necessarily affect the common cold. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. The thing that they've looked at, which might help a little bit, is zinc.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yeah.
I think the other thing that I think is really interesting, and I think firstly, kudos, Brian, for what you just said, because I think that's the thing, is superstition exists in the gaps of science. And, you know, in the past, there was no science in the past, and so it was all superstition. As science has slowly started to figure things out, superstition has become relegated to smaller and smaller domains. The other thing that I was going to say, and I think that is really important about the vitamin C thing, is that mostly comes from Linus Pauling. And, you know, Linus Pauling won the Nobel Prize for chemistry, and then he also won one for peace. So very, very reputable scientist. But just because you're a reputable scientist and you have good research in one area, that doesn't mean that you're an expert in every area or that you should trust everything that the person says.
It goes back to what Dr. Chen was talking about.
Yeah.
What kind of doctor are you? If you're a microbiologist and you're talking about cancer, that's not your area of specialty.
But even when you are, I mean, like Peter Duesenberg, right?
Yeah.
The HIV denialist. He's done great research in some areas, but the point is that the claims that he is making about HIV just are not supported by the data. I think it has to be even not about the person. It really has to be individual claim. What does the study show? Is that study, you know, solid, and is it, you know, peer reviewed, and, you know, are there flaws in the study and all that sort of stuff? It has to be about the idea, not the person, I think, at least.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, yeah. We're pontificating now, Dr.
Yeah.
Chen. but I think the points make sense. I think that what you're saying is important, because I think a lot of people spend a lot of time and a lot of money on things that they are told work from people who haven't done the research, and I've fallen for it, and so have a lot of people.
Yeah, and I think they have to be careful. Is it, you know, the information that they're getting, is it from a nonprofit source that isn't going to benefit at all from what the person does, or is it from a source that actually is going to benefit from someone buying something or using something? And I think that actually obviously is an important thing to look at too.
Well, I hope, for one, that you get the money that you're looking for from. I'm actually shocked that you can't, that it's actually difficult for you to get money for such important research. But it makes sense. You're not going to get it from the pharmaceutical companies, because there's no vested interest in them proving that aspirin, something that's already generically available, is more effective than, say, some of their bigger drugs.
Exactly. And then the government funding, again, similar to the what it's like getting it published in a peer-reviewed journal, about 5% of grants get funded.
5%?
Yes.
How does that – I guess you have to present a paper to the various government officials and hope for the best?
You basically put together a sort of a scientific background and rationale for why you think your study is being done, and then you're going to present on why and how you're going to do that study. And then they actually have a large group of people that critique you, and then they critique you based upon, is your scientific question good or not? And then they also critique you on – is the way that you want to do your study good or not? Because you have to be able to do both of those things well. You have to have a good question, but then you also have to have a good way to answer that question.
And there are also, I mean, just as, you know, there are biases within big pharma, there are biases within the grant allocating process. I mean, who they give money to, why they give money to them.
Human beings. What's cool, all of that stuff.
What's popular and trendy.
Right.
Yeah, just like there are popular trends in Hollywood, there are popular trends in science, too.
I love it. Well,
yeah.
we're all human beings.
Right.
I very much appreciate your time, and
sure.
I learned a lot here. I think it's important just to hear from a real scientist and a credible scientist and a published scientist exactly how you go about building a reputation and how you go about doing research. Real eye-opener for me. So
great. Well, I'm really glad that you decided to talk about this topic, because I think it's a really important one.
And I had one last question. Why do we not – is there any sort of move to crowdfund – studies? Because I think that's the thing, is that a lot of this stuff the public would be interested in, and, you know, if the grant writing bodies have their biases and the pharmaceutical companies don't care, if you reach out to the general public, a lot of the general public would be happy to chip in $5, and you add all those $5 up.
So there definitely are people who have used crowdfunding successfully to get smaller projects done. When I say smaller projects done, I mean 15,000, 50,000, even 100,000, something like that. For a large study like this, like I said, our estimated budget, but this was on the low side, was 10 million. Ideally, we'd have a little bit more than that. To get that via crowdfunding alone without giving someone something would be difficult to do with crowdfunding.
Well, unless we get you on the Brian Callen show.
Yeah.
Right, that's true.
Give money. But I want very quickly, one last question also. Now, I want to piggyback on this. Because I've heard that getting for the pharmaceutical company to actually get a drug on market, when they start with an idea, let's test this molecule and let's bring it all the way through to human trials. Now let's get it to market. I've heard that can cost $160 million. Or something.
Definitely. And over that. Absolutely.
And over that. So, $200 million, let's say.
Oh, it definitely can, and that includes marketing costs and all these other sorts of things. So it can be extraordinarily expensive. It doesn't have to be, but
right.
It can be.
But this is crazy because so not only are the costs astronomical to get a market a drug to market, but I understand also that they when the drugs are reviewed, a lot of times the scientists on those panels can work for rival pharmaceutical companies. Is that true?
Yes, that is true. The FDA has tried to be better about that. They actually used to basically allow anyone to be on an advisory panel as long as they were, you know, of a good scientific reputation. But the trouble is, even if you have good scientific reputation, as you said, you may already have allegiances either for or against a particular company. And so now the FDA has gotten better about trying to make sure that that doesn't happen.
So how in the world, when you're prescribed, you have a disease and you're prescribed a drug, mm-hmm. How in the world do you test as a layman? How do you test its efficacy? I mean, how in the world do you do that?
Oh, you can't just on yourself as an individual. It's not really. That's why we need to do trials, because like I said, if you, for instance, have a pain medication, you say, gee, I feel better. You just don't know how much of that was due to the pain medication. How much was that just due to the fact that you took a different pill than you did before?
Or what you ate on a particular day. But we also
need a central database, don't we? And we don't have that. Hospitals don't talk to each other, do they?
Right. No, not really. No. Mm.
All right. Well, thank you. At least we isolated some of the problems and we...
and it seems like, I mean, the main problem is communication.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's doctors communicating with each other. It's doctors communicating with the public. It's, you know, it's the public, you know, making sure that they have enough understanding to be able to tell the difference between a good study and a bad study. It's really, I mean, it all comes down to the movement of ideas, mostly.
Hmm. Well... Dr. Chen, thank you so much for your time.
Great, thank you once again.
A second goodbye. And I love these kind of conversations, man. You make a big difference, so we appreciate it. And
great. Well, thanks for taking the time on this.
It was awesome. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you,
You're
Dr.
welcome.
Chen.
Have a good day. You're
right.
Welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye. There it is, ladies and gentlemen.
There you go.
You learn where cancer comes from. You learn how to prevent it. I don't know.
With some probability.
That's right. I think you made a good point. Probability is everything.
Yeah, that's all it is.
That's your science background. Good questions, Hunter Motz. Good questions, Brian Callen.
Amazing questions, Brian
Callen. Good question, Rena Marie. All right, guys. Thank you very much. That's the Brian Callen Show.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.